panel discussion was designed to address the first desired outcome, identify, clarify what science says about making compensatory mitigation decisions in a watershed context. In your conference materials, there's an appendix, labeled Appendix A, starts on page 115, and under the heading Supporting Scientific Literature. And we've included in this three articles, which our speakers felt would be of interest to you, which they'll likely be referring to today. The final presentation, we've got a bit of a cushion here with time, which is novel. we have some time set aside, at least 30 minutes, depending on how long I speak, for question and answer. There's not going to be a facilitated session there, just a question and answer to our speakers. It's such a great opportunity to have them here. They being Barbara Bedford and Richard Sumner. Barbara Bedford joined Cornell University's Department of Natural Resources in 1989, having served as Associate Director of the University's Ecosystems Research Center since 1980. Her research focuses on wetland plant diversity, what controls it, how human actions affect it, and how to manage it. Richard Sumner has been with EPA's Wetlands Program for over 25 years. He is the regional liaison for EPA's National Wetlands Program and works with the agency's ecology laboratory in Corvallis, Oregon, on behalf of the 10 EPA regional offices and for the agency's Office of Water. I will let you take it over from here.
What's relevant here? I'm going to focus on those things that I know best. I'm going to assume you read the papers. I'm not going to repeat them. As I tell my students, I assume you did your readings. I'm not going to go over them for you. I am going to emphasize certain things because it's my perspective, because I understand it, and because I think it's essential to a watershed approach. And that is how we think. How we think, you know, what the model is that we have in our head really affects how we go about doing our business. And in watershed management, watershed science, we've been thinking for a long time on a superficial level. I'm going to emphasize, and I don't mean superficial in the sense of not deep, I mean in a two-dimensional sense. I'm going to be focusing on thinking in 3D and thinking at several scales. I was unable to transfer my talk from my computer, so I'm going to be moving up here. I want to start by giving credit where credit is due. Those of you who know Tom Winter, USGS Denver, know that he is one of the best hydrologists and hydrogeologists that we have in the country. I started working with Tom in 1987, and much of what I have written, much of what I understand, is because it was Tom Winter who taught me that wetlands are hydrologic units of the landscape in a much more complicated way than I had ever previously understood. Eric Preston at EPA Corvallis is the one who got me to start thinking about cumulative impact assessment. You can't think about cumulative impact assessment unless you think at the scale of ecoregions and watersheds. Kathy's one of my grad students who helped me with the graphics because I'm not particularly literate on that. Robert Wesley is the botanist, taxonomist, and photographer with whom I worked for 2 decades now, and you'll see a couple of his pictures very shortly. And then there's another "and especially," and the "and especially" goes to you. I was really humbled when I read your biography. You are the people who are out there on a day-to-day basis. I come to these workshops because I teach wetland management and ecology. I teach landscape impact analysis. And I feel that I need to be in contact with people who are in the world really doing these things. I hope that I'm producing students or educating students to go out and do what you're doing. In reading the projects that were summarized and reading your biographies, I am awed and humbled to be here with you. I think we're all most interested in these beautiful wetlands that we're trying to do something about, and you're the ones who are really doing something about it. The charge that was given to us is this open-ended set of questions. What are the appropriate units? Well, that's a big question. What's the appropriate scale for watershed assessment? What's the relationship of function to location? And are there any other considerations that we should think about? So that's what they want Rich and me to deal with. Now, EPA's definition of the watershed approach, I'm highlighting here what I think is really essential. Coordinating framework. It's not a recipe book. It is a framework. It is a way of thinking. Highest priority problems recognizes not enough time, not enough money. We got to set some priorities here. The two areas that I'm really going to focus on in this talk are these last two. Hydrologically defined geographic areas and ground and surface water flow. Must think about both. So this is what I'm going to try to cover. The bulk of the talk is in the basics of 3D thinking. There's an old Yiddish saying, we can only learn what we already know, and that's why I'm really humbled, because I suspect that what I'm going to be telling you is stuff you already know. And then I'm going to go to the four questions, and I hope, in fact, in the first part to have indirectly answered all of them. I love Larson. So here's the problem we have, right? Where are we going to put the weather? We all know not here, right? But do we know where to put it? Where in the watershed? So those of you who've heard me talk before, I think it may be just Rich and Tracy, may have seen this slide before. This is a mosaic from Sage Chapel at Cornell University. It's obviously a mosaic. For many years, I thought about watersheds in the sense of pieces that were spatially related to each other. And there were different kinds of land uses or soil types or mattered. And in the visioning process, of course, we ask stakeholders, well, what's your vision? Would you like this to be all that? Or would you like some variety? Would you like different kinds of ecosystems in your watershed? Would you like a lot of wetland, a little wetland? Well, what I want you to do is to think in cross-section at the same time that you're thinking, looking down on the landscape, down on the watershed, if you will. In order to think about watersheds and the movement of surface and groundwater, we must do a cross-section. We must think about what's going on the surface as well as under the surface. Now, monks in the 6th century delineated the wine-growing areas of France, and they knew then where the Grand Crus grew and where the Premier Crus grew, etc. They hadn't dug down below the soil, but they actually put the lines where the geology changes. This comes from a book called Terroir. I can't speak French, but it means all of the characteristics of an area that produce particular types of wine, and that includes what goes on below ground. That's a much more recent book, but the monks somehow knew it in the 6th century. So let's think about some basics that we know about what determines wetland types. It's a set of environmental gradients. We know that there's a very, very complex set of gradients, but we know what those gradients are. There's things like water level fluctuation, plant-limiting nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus in the surface water, base cations, pH alkalinity, water flow, and those determine which type of a wetland is likely to develop. But in thinking about restoration and thinking about watersheds, we have to ask, what controls the gradients? The basic tenet of landscape ecology is that spatial position matters.
And what's going to go on in a wetland is a function of what's adjacent to it, and in the sense that I'm talking about, also below the surface in that watershed. So this should be familiar to some of you. This is the USGS's National Water Summary on Wetland Resources. Water budgets. Water in, water out. Always asking, where does the water come from? Where does it go to? What fraction of the water coming in is precip? Because precip has not very many base cations. Not much nitrogen or phosphorus, unless you happen to be in the Northeast. And then we want to know, well, where is it going? Is the water going back into the ground? Is it going to a stream that we care about the water quality from? So these components tell us not only what the chemistry and the type of the wetland is likely to be, but it also tells us whether the wetland is going to have an effect on downstream waters. Now, what's interesting about this picture is it is in three dimensions. It does recognize that what goes on underground, i.e., groundwater in, groundwater out, matters, as well as surface water in, surface water out. So, understanding wetlands in the context of their associated groundwater flow systems, essential to assessing the cumulative effects of wetlands on water quality, groundwater flow, and stream flow in large areas. These are the basic wetland functions we care about, in addition, of course, to habitat provision. Now, because I'm going to be talking about groundwater, I'm going to use this to make a point. This is a figure from one of Tom Winter's papers that appeared in Wetlands. It's the water balances of different wetlands in the landscape. And what I want you to focus on is this kind of shading, which is groundwater in, groundwater out, evaporation out, stream flow out, right? So the top one, Muir Lake, Fenn, groundwater in is most of the input, and stream flow out is most of the outflow. Now, what does that tell you about the potential for this particular wetland to affect water quality downstream? A lot. A lot. Where does this particular type of a wetland occur? It occurs only in particular types of landscapes, in particular places in the landscape, where there can be a sustained input of groundwater. The fan up there, the other one that has a similar pattern, a little bit different balance. This is one of the prairie pothole wetlands. In this one, precip is a main input. Very little groundwater. So a very different kind of a picture, and this is located in a very different position in the landscape. And most of the water out is evaporation. It's not going to downstreams. The Island Lake one is interesting because in this case, the water out is going into the groundwater. So we need to think always about where's the water coming from, where is it going to, and then what about the position in the landscape is it that determines that? Mm-hmm. Winter has developed what he refers to as 24 type settings. They are combinations of physiography and climate. And he feels that these, actually has a lot of data to support it, these regions behave similarly hydrologically. The letters on there refer to what I'm going to show you next. He plotted the groundwater component of stream flow in 10 of these type settings. Now, you can think about streams as reflecting in some way the wetlands in a region, or you can also think about the streams in terms of, in part, what we're trying to protect under the Clean Water Act. The blue is the groundwater contribution to stream flow, and what you see, of course, is that it varies geographically, but that it is always there and always important. Now, we know that some systems don't receive groundwater, so I'm not making that point. I am making the point that around the country, and not just in the humid Northeast, we need to think about groundwater. A perspective that I have tried to promote, and it's really the geologist, it's the hydrogeologist, it's Tom Winters, it's Don Siegels, it's Jim LaBaugh, and a bunch of people who are hydrogeologists. So what is the hydrogeologic setting? We've thought about HGM, and Mark Brinson really has advanced our the way we think about wetlands and wetland function with HGM. The hydrogeologic setting is a somewhat broader concept. It's all the characteristics of the watershed, which is what we want to understand in the watershed approach, that control the chemistry and the flows of surface water and groundwater to a wetland. So understanding that, this could be a basin wetland, you know, depression wetland, a slope wetland, a flat, but those all exist within particular hydrogeologic settings. So this particular diagram shows you cross-sections of hydrogeological settings for wetlands, again from the USGS National Summary on Water Resources. The top one, depressional slope breaks, so location in the watershed. And what you see there is that the surface topography matters. What you see in the next one, areas of stratigraphic change. The subsurface geology matters. Where the water emerges is a function of the particular characteristics of the subsurface materials. The bottom one, you can either think of as a permafrost area, you happen to be one of those people who works in Alaska, or you can think of this as bedrock, areas where bedrock is close to the surface and bedrock or permafrost will prevent water from moving down. So, what are the specific characteristics of hydrogeologic setting? Climate, obviously. I'm going to show you some things relevant here. The wetland position in the landscape, is it high in the watershed, is it low in the watershed, is it adjacent to the stream, isolated from the stream, isolated, low down, and the geologic characteristics of the watershed. So if you just focus on the top part of this one, you see a riverine wetland on the left and a humid part of the country on the right and an arid part of the country. Just look at that a second. I actually give this to my students as a problem set. So what those diagrams show you is, of course, what we all know already. We only learn what you already know. Climate drives the hydrologic cycle. So what your restoration can achieve in an arid zone is much different from what you can achieve in a humid zone, because your water balances change. What goes in and what goes out change in relative proportion to each other. So we see that in the humid area, precip in, evapotranspiration out, about equal. In the arid zone, less precip out and a lot of ET out. Groundwater in the arid zone, minor. In the humid zone, major. So you can do this. I mean, the same thing happens down here with the humid and the arid lacustrine wetland. So climate is a main driver of the hydrologic cycle, and we must always think about what that background is. Now, the other characteristic that was second on that list was location in the watershed. And we can think about location, you know, next to the power plant, or we can think about location in terms of its position relative to the flows of surface and groundwater. A basic concept in hydrogeology is the concept of the nested groundwater flow systems. So what you see here is a schematic of groundwater flow in the Prairie Pothole region. It's very generalized. Believe me, nothing below ground ever looks that simple, right, Ken? But the principle that it's illustrating is something really important to think about in terms of where you put your wetland. Up there on top where it says recharged wetland, those are the wetlands that receive primarily precip.
That might be where your bog would be if it were in the Prairie Puddle, which is in a different climatic zone. Those wetlands actually move water downward because they are on topographic highs, regional topographic highs. So that's one point, high in the watershed. Then there is low in the watershed. This diagram actually would be better if this were down here. But discharge wetland. Note that there are three arrows coming into that. Now that's really important if you're thinking about what do you want that wetland to look like. Water coming locally, the top arrow. Water coming from an intermediate flow system and water coming from a regional flow system. I'm going to show you some more diagrams just to get this three-dimensional view into your minds. But position in the watershed is extremely important in terms of what you're going to get. Downstream, you're going to get more dissolved ions because the water travels farther, picks up whatever is in the watershed. So that matters what's here. If it's limestone, you're going to get a very different wetland than if it's the sand in South Florida, because those are very flat terrains. Now let's just take one type of wetland. This is a more specific close-up view of location. All Ridge Bends is the work of Carol Thompson, who was with the Iowa GS, is now at a college in Texas. So just take one type of fen and you get three different types depending upon where in the watershed it is. And where is a function of not looking down on the landscape, I'm looking in cross section. The slope fen arises where groundwater can move out and form a seepage on the slope. The mound fen occurs where there's actually a breach in lacustrine clay and water discharges to the surface. And then a lake edge wetland where it actually builds out over the lake and develops again because there's groundwater moving through the sand and gravel. Water seeks the path of least resistance, moves from high head to low head. So now let's think about the geologic characteristics of hydrogeological setting. Surface topography is obvious. You have a depression or you have a slope. Well, you know, lakes form only in depressions. Wetlands form in all topographic positions. So what does that tell you? That means you've got to understand what's underneath. Why do some basins have wetlands, some not? Function of what's underneath. Land surface slope, where are most of our wetlands? The coastal plain, southern Florida, southern Louisiana, very flat land surface slope. Water moves from high head to low head. If your slant is slanted like so, it's going to run off fast. If it's slanted like so, it's going to sit there for a while. All right, thickness and permeability of the soil. Soil can actually hold up the movement of groundwater. Also determines what the chemistry is. Let's go to take a look at some of this. So topography will determine whether a wetland forms at a slope break or it forms in a river channel. Now, geologic characteristics. We actually mapped all the fens in New York State, and the correlation with carbonate bedrock was extremely good, but as you can see, not entirely correlated. But once we map the carbonate surficial deposits and the fens on top of those, we found that that's where all the fens were to be found. And we now have the ability to predict where a fen was or ought to be. Fens we didn't know the locations of. Based on the models we developed, we figured out where to look and we found them. So, influence of stratigraphy and hydraulic properties of geologic materials on wetland formation. Now take a look at this. This is a little scary in terms of watershed planning. This is a little scary. So, here are the wetlands down here. They're called, this is Cedar Bog in Ohio.
very famous wetland. Where's the water coming from? It's coming from over here. Not adjacent, but over here. Why? Because of the way in which the geological materials are layered. Forces water to follow the path of least resistance through the glacial outwash. The bedrock below it forces the water up. Thank you. Really scary. This is Western Kentucky. Look at that. This is karst terrain in the Mississippian plateaus of Kentucky. That is really complicated below ground. But what these schematics say is that in most regions, the geologists have these kinds of understandings of what's going on below ground, and they can help us understand where particular types of wetlands would develop and where they might not develop. And here's an even scarier one. This is Virginia. So you see crystalline rock, which yields nothing, so you get bog-like vegetation, up against limestone here. So hot springs and seeps, you're likely to get fans because of the high calcium carbonate content. Here's sandstone, so that water's not picking up much of anything off of that quartz sandstone. It's very different wetlands developing. This is the same landscape. Probably a different watershed on either side this high. You need to go to the bottom line in my lecture when I talk to my students about this is
Virginia, right?
If in doubt, find a geologist. These are the variables we use to characterize the hydrogeologic setting of New York fens. It's a relatively reasonable set of variables. Not that you have to have them all when you do your planning, but you better think about them. Their chemical, physical, and spatial characteristics, all that influence whether you get a particular type of wetland forming. The mineralogy of the subsurface material will determine what the chemistry of the water is, along with what proportion of the water is coming from surface, groundwater, or precip, which has precip is referred to as a dilute medium because it has few minerals in it. Depending upon what the water is moving through, the surface water and the groundwater will give you different chemistry and therefore different types of wetlands. Area and gradient. One of the things that we found very important were things like flow path length. How far does the water move over the surface? How far does it move through the groundwater before it reaches the wetland? The ratio of the wetland to the watershed area. If the watershed is large relative to the size of the wetland, the watershed will have a much greater influence. We find bogs occurring, quarter of a mile away from a fen because the bog happens to have such a small watershed that even though it sits in a limestone glacial material, there's not enough water coming from the watershed to influence, so we get a bog. Topographic index is basically slope. You get steep slopes, groundwater becomes very important, especially if those hills that they're coming from is glacial till. Landform, so local landform, that's basically HGM. The basin, is it a basin, is it a trough? Is it a flat? And is it connected to surface water inputs or outputs? Okay, so back to the charge. Okay? Here's the answer key. Do you remember the question? Okay? So, what's the appropriate unit? Watersheds, ecoregions, other? I'll go into these later, but the answer is both plus the political. You cannot sidestep the fact that we operate in core districts, EPA regions, counties, states, etc. Now, what's the question on number two? I gave you the answer. What's the question?
Scale.
Scale. Right. You are off base if you are thinking a single scale. That's always the wrong answer. It's not so clear what the right answer is. It's multiple. Well, what's multiple? Well, I said less than six because you simply can't do it. You try to operate at more than six scales and you're just way beyond your comprehension. But you must think at the scale of the particular wetland you're trying to restore, and you must think at the scale of its watershed, its immediate watershed. You may also need to think beyond that, but minimally you need to think about its watershed. Now, in the watershed approach, there's an assumption there that we're not speaking of a single wetland and its local watershed. We're thinking of a larger watershed with many wetlands in it. So ideally, you're looking at what's referred to as a landscape. What types of wetlands do you have in that landscape, and what are the characteristics at the landscape level, and then what are the characteristics of the watersheds that determine whether or not you can restore a particular type of wetland in a particular place? Third question?
What is this?
When I read this question, I thought, oh.
What's it? Other landscapes.
Relation of location to function. Now it's the real estate answer.
Yeah, really.
Everything is location. Everything is location. You cannot think about wetland function unless you think about location. So location, location, and location are the answers. And then the college is out on the final one. It depends. It always depends. There isn't an answer. It's a thinking process. It depends on what are your goals. It depends on what's the region you're operating in. It depends on what are your constraints. You know, if you had endless money and endless time, you'd all have GIS systems for all of your watersheds, and you could sit at your computer and you'd have soil, surficial geology, bedrock geology, surface hydrography, land use, soil type, etc. But you don't. So instead, you need to get that kind of mentality in your head so that, as John, I think, said, you do these permits, but the person doing them has the understanding and is doing these. What characteristics of the landscape really matter? They're doing it on the fly. But they're doing it with a head that is infused with an understanding of wetlands, their watersheds, and their landscapes. So, watersheds, you do watersheds. Ecoregions, we can do ecoregions. Or as Eric Preston and I recommended in 1988, I hate to think I've been at this long, Eric actually got me to come and run this workshop with a four-month-old baby breastfeeding. So here we just overlaid USGS, can't remember what size, Rel probably can tell by looking at them, which huck that is?
Big one.
But conceptually,
my eyesight's not that good.
Conceptually, you can do this at any scale you want. So, depending on where your watershed is, you may find it includes several ecoregions or just one ecoregion. Right? This was imprinted in black and white in the journal, and I don't have the original graphic anymore. So, why or why not watersheds? This is telling you guys. Telling you guys. Why? The Clean Water Act, right? That's what we work with. We work with the Clean Water Act. So, water is the primary variable controlling wetlands. So that's why we deal with watersheds. Why not? Why not? Well, because ecoregions
tell us a lot about the fundamental characteristics that influence water chemistry in a particular reach. So as Jim Omernick has shown in several papers he's put out there, if you have a watershed like so, and you've got this ecoregion cutting here and this ecoregion cutting here, now lo and behold, the fish in this reach look different from the fish in this reach. Well, so then you've got to pay attention to both if you're interested in the fish. So you probably have to pay attention to both. The other, why not watersheds? In some parts of the country, they're just really hard to define. In areas with really defined topography, you can outline them. But in other areas of the country, they're very hard to outline. In the Prairie Pothole region, they have done so much drainage that the watersheds that look like they ought to be watersheds on the basis of surface topography are not, because the water's coming from across a watershed divide because of drainage ditches. Another reason why not watersheds, in flat terrain like Florida, the boundaries are not fixed. Several inches of rain and oops, they topped the so-called, boundary of the watershed, and now they're flowing into another watershed. So you can't just, watershed's not a problem, that's obviously what we're going to use. Obviously, you have to have them in your mind. And I make my students go through the exercise of, okay, here's a topo map. There's six wetlands on it. Draw me the watershed. Now, why not ecoregions? While it is the Clean Water Act, we do desire to protect habitat. And I want to give you a reminder. This is something I learned a couple years ago that I didn't know. As my biography says, I'm fascinated with biological diversity. And odds are, those of you who are up trucking around wetlands are likewise, because it just kind of blows your mind. What I have here is a map of global biodiversity. The standard wisdom is the most diverse ecosystems in the world occur in the tropics. So diversity zones, number of species per area, the highest being the red. Where are the red? The red's in the tropics. So, U.S., the area we work in, by those standards, are pretty boring. But there is increasing evidence that latitudinal trend in diversity is reversed for herbaceous wetlands. That the most diverse systems, herbaceous wetlands, occur in the north temperate zone. Isn't that cool? former postdoc of mine is actually working on this, Aaron Ellison. And you see here the number of wetland grass species. Ithaca, New York is at 42 north latitude. Right? So you go to the Yucatan and you go out in those marshes and you see two species. I go out into the wetlands around Ithaca, New York, and plots the meter square of 35 different species of plants. It's very cool. So I'm going to skip this one. Global. Why ecoregions? I didn't realize this as well. In terms of global diversity, the U.S., in terms of number of biomes and number of ecoregions, depending upon whose definition you're using, has more than those other countries. And in terms of global diversity, because by virtue of the topographic, geological, climatic diversity we have in this country, which are reflected in our wetlands, we support an immense amount of diversity. Hence, the Nature Conservancy and other organizations that are really interested in diversity use ecoregions. They don't use watersheds. Okay, scales. Greater than one, less than six. Project, obviously you gotta look at the project, but that's the wrong one. Individual wetland, you gotta look at the individual project, but that's the wrong one, because you gotta know its characteristics, and therefore you gotta look at its watershed. But, this is the United States Army Corps of Engineers and the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the Federal Highway Administration, the scales that we should be thinking about are bigger.
What's the picture that we get in entire landscapes? What's the picture we get in entire regions? What do we want in those regions? What do we want in those landscapes? And that is what's possible. So I think I made this point before, location, location, location. Surface water and groundwater interacts throughout the landscape. And depending upon topography, surficial geology, land surface slope, different types of wetlands develop. And they develop as a function of those characteristics, and those characteristics are what we mean by location. We don't just mean adjacent to the shopping mall. We mean where do they sit in surface and groundwater flow systems, because what we're interested in is the Clean Water Act. So here's your three-dimensional location, location, location. Because as I said, I'm humble and I wasn't going to answer all your questions. I proposed this in a 99 paper that I think you have, and it's more complete in there. What we want is a picture of a landscape, a profile, and Mary Conchula at EPA Corvallis has really carried this far beyond what I did and has actually done some of this, and you have a paper by Gwynn and Cantula and someone else that tells you how to do this. But I put this up here because this geographical analysis of templates, now face the final frontier. In looking at your landscape, you really want to know what's already been lost and where has it been lost from, for two reasons. Not just to know where to put them, but because the proportion lost and where they've been lost constrains what we can restore. The prairie potholes have been so drained that the regional groundwater table has dropped. So in some cases, we can't put wetlands back where they were. So we need to know where they've been lost and what proportion has been lost. So we need a picture of the history, right? Where have we been in terms of figuring out where we're going to? Famous data put together by National Wetlands Inventory, but I took it, this diagram out of a book, a different book. When I think about, you know, protecting wetlands in the U.S., I have to remind myself that the picture is highly variable and that there are some parts of the country in which we've lost a lot, and therefore we should, some of our priorities should be to look at those areas in terms of where, you know, could we really put them back, or do we commit triage? And we say, okay, these are the regions where we've still got something and it's more possible to do things, let's do them there. I think those questions are worth asking. Okay, this person's going to die no matter what I do. This one, if I work on it, I could save. And this one's going to survive no matter what I do. So, triage. The Midwest, the data are incredible. Drained farmland in the Midwest in the 30s. Every one of those dots, the bigger, the larger, and the biggest is, represents 100,000 acres. Almost all of the sedge meadows and wet prairies of the U.S. are gone because of where they naturally occurred. So it's a wetland type that protecting and restoring is really important. Now, here's to give you hope. Right? I noticed that ELI's latest edition features the marshes of Iraq, the marsh people. These data are pulled off of satellite because, of course, at the time, which was the mid-70s, no one was looking there, so they went back and looked at the old satellite data. These are the marshes that sat between the Euphrates and the Tigris River, the birthplace of civilization. And what this says is that all these dark areas were permanent marsh, the yellow were seasonal, the gray were mud flats, the deep blue were permanent lakes, and the light blue were shallow seasonal lakes. And by 1990, the satellite photos told us that all of that white had been drained. and gone, and that these areas, the beige, were dead and dry vegetation, and the only permanent marsh remaining was up there. There's now an effort to restore them, but you know the context these people are working in. We are working in a much better environment if all of your brain power, all of your experience, and a country in which we can work to restore these things. Back to my mosaic, because there's another quote that I want you to keep in mind, because I do, and it really helps me on some days. It's from Pogo. Remember Pogo? Yep. We are confronted by insurmountable opportunities. Right? So anyway, thanks for listening to me.
Do a little shifting of technology here.
Right.
After Rick speaks, I guess Barbara will ask you to, if you can stay up here a match after. While we do that, we can take like one question, but I actually had a question that's very practical in nature. Can you talk about individual wetlands, complex of wetlands, and then region? Do those at all correspond to like, it's like a huck, you know,
depends on what numbers to get a sense of your venture at. If you go back, well, now I just disconnected. How different people define regions varies, and the definition that was up there on the board was from, was my modification from a textbook by Foreman on landscape ecology. And more typically in these regions, as opposed to the concept of ecoregion, which are defined on the basis of soils, topography, physiography, potential natural vegetation, these regions are defined, those regions, by Foreman on the basis of a repetitive cluster of ecosystem types plus the economic, social, political characteristics of the region. Planners use that concept in the sense of the prairie pothole is a region. It's agriculture, shallow depressions filled with marshes, the same kind of physiography. The Atlantic coastal plain is a region. It's similar, repetitive ecosystems.
Give a sense of the size of what you mean when you say this. Is there any way to say like what this generally corresponds to?
Individual wetland can vary from the size of this room
right.
to very, very large.
When you talk about landscape, I mean, in terms of like a, you said obviously there's nested watersheds in the region, of the immediate watershed. When you talk about landscape, is there any way you can generalize about what tuck you'd be, the size you'd be dealing with in order to sort of, okay?
No.
8 to 20.
Okay.
Digits.
Thank you.
Yeah.
8 to 20. And then, so individual is...
I'm kidding.
No?
I mean, there is a 20 digit. I've never heard of
that. Okay.
It depends. Because a landscape, by definition, is a coordinated set of ecosystems that interact with each other. So you could define that at any scale that you wanted to.
You have to regulate it. I need the answer.
No, I wasn't going to give you any answers.
Right.
But you did. I wrote them down.
Oh, good. Does anyone have a question for Barbara? And then we're going to move to Rich's presentation. We'll have plenty of time for questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
I think, Josh, I believe you're the one that mentioned that dichotomy between science and regulatory, I guess, and I mean, you know, I really love what you talk about, Barbara, but I don't see that translation. You know, I know there are good people in districts that could do the, that have a knowledge of their watershed and their hydrogeologic settings and stuff like that, but in many cases there aren't enough people to actually implement that in the process. So I guess I see that as a real huge problem.
It's huge. There's no question about it. You know, Rich says it's getting a gestalt.
Yeah.
And then you people are the ones that do the specifics, which is why I said I was humbled. You know, I look at what you're trying to do. You're doing the right thing. I look at the projects that PLI summarized.
These guys got it. They understand it. They get it.